I hope you're here to think with me and reflect a little bit on a psychology of shame. If you thought you were going to be doing something else, now's the time to go find Bach or whatever the other session is that's going on. Somebody has said that all doctoral dissertations are, at least in large part, autobiographical. Barbara Rossing is laughing up there. I don't know what she's writing on. But.
The Book of Revelation.
Well, there you go.
She's
still waiting to find hers. My doctoral dissertation in the pastoral theology program at Princeton Seminary was entitled Shame and Baptism, Law and Gospel and Human Experience. It was about 10 years ago I first, somewhat by accident, picked up a book on shame called On Shame and the Search for Identity by Helen Merrill Lind, which I did not know when I began reading it was a quite classic volume on shame, one of the earliest and best pieces of writing about the topic of shame. There was something in that topic that resonated very deeply with me that at that point I could not really put a finger on. I'm not totally sure I can still, but I began to discover that there was a lot to this topic, a lot more than I had ever thought about, and a lot more, it seemed to me, than had been written about in the fields of both psychology and theology. By the way, Barbara introduced me as a pastoral psychologist. I'm really not that. I'm not a licensed psychologist. I am a pastoral theologian. If you came because you thought I was a pastoral psychologist, that's great. I'm glad you're here. If it kept somebody away, then clarify that for your friends. Pastoral theology is a field that really deals with reflection on human experience. One of my professors at Princeton, Jim Lapsley, who is a founding person in this field, I guess you'd say, has described it as grubbing about in the root systems of humankind. And I think that's about as good a description as you can get. Trying to understand why human beings behave, relate, interact the way we do, and what that means theologically. So we've mapped out three sessions here pertaining to shame. Today, a psychology of shame. Tomorrow, a theology of shame, and the third on Wednesday, entitled An Antidote for Shame. We'll unfold those as we go along. I'd like to share with you as we begin here a prayer from one of my favorite sources. Ted Loader is a United Methodist pastor in Philadelphia, has written this book, Guerrillas of Grace. The title implies that he thinks that people of grace are something really like guerrilla warriors who lurk in the weeds and strike at the unexpected moments, that grace is not something you plan for or map out very carefully, it just sort of happens. And he prays very poetically and deeply. So I share this with you, this prayer entitled, Empty Me. Gracious and Holy One, Creator of all things and of emptiness, I come to you full of much that clutters and distracts, stifles and burdens me, and makes me a burden to others. Empty me now of gnawing dissatisfactions, of anxious imaginings, of fretful preoccupations, of nagging prejudices, of old scores to settle, and of the arrogance of being right. Empty me of the ways I unthinkingly think of myself as powerless, as a victim, as determined by sex, age, race, as being less than I am or as other than yours. Empty me of the disguises and lies in which I hide myself from other people and from my responsibility for my neighbors and for the world. Hollow out in me a space in which I will find myself, find peace, and a whole heart, a forgiving spirit, and holiness, the springs of laughter, and the will to reach boldly for abundant life for myself and the whole human family. And he doesn't say it, but I'll say it. Amen.
Well,
let me ask, I hope this will be a participatory session, and feel free to add your comments and questions. Just ask that you raise your hand as you do that. It helps me to spot you. It's also helpful for any that have a bit of difficulty hearing. It's nice to be able to spot who's speaking as they begin to speak. So we'll ask you to indicate with your hand when you want to jump into the discussion, and I'll try to keep everybody sorted out. As I said, this session is entitled, very intentionally, A Psychology of Shame. I don't in any way pretend to say this is the definitive psychology of shame. I will share several perspectives with you, but I don't know as anyone has written the definitive psychology of shame. It's would be a rather big task, I think. I hope simply to give some framework and some overview for us so you can have some things to bounce your ideas off of. That's not really right. Your experiences off of. Shame is not not something that can be dealt with very intellectually. It's much more experiential, I guess. I want to say, too, I think I'm probably the only person alive in America who's studied shame at some depth and has not read John Bradshaw. So if you have read or listened to his tapes, which the little that I have sampled I think are quite good and helpful about healing the shame that binds you and so forth, you might jump in, especially where you think that's relevant. He has popularized shame in a way that I think has done a great favor to the topic. I'm trying to go a little behind that to help us unfold some of the sources that he uses in that popularized approach to shame. But as I say, if you have some knowledge about that, why, feel free to add it in here. I think we could say basically that there are two psychological schools of thought about shame. That's a considerable oversimplification, but we have about 50 minutes to go here, so we'll run with that. Even with that, even if we say we boil it down to two basic schools of thought, it's still, I think, very accurate to say that in the history of modern psychology, if you date that somewhere from Sigmund Freud in the late 19th, early 20th century, shame has been incredibly overlooked. And I think in the last 10 or 15 years only have we seen a burgeoning interest in shame, a lot of writing coming out about shame, but strangely not much before that. This book I mentioned by Helen Merrill Lynd was published in 1957 and was one of the earliest and best reflections on shame, but it kind of floated out there in the psychological community for 20 years or so before people began to pick up on it and follow it on through. You'll find some things in the writings of Freud about shame, although much more about guilt, as you know, if you have any even passing knowledge of what Freud was about. But by and large, there was not a lot done with shame until really very recently, 10 or 15 years ago. But if we boil that down into two schools of thought, I think we could say, do I have any room left to write up here? On the one hand, there's a way of thinking about shame that comes out of a sort of conflict model. And this school of thought would build very much on Freud and would say that shame is generated by a kind of interpsychic conflict, basically within my own person. As you know, Freud talked about the ego, the superego, and the id, three parts of the personality. The ego being, if you know the transactional analysis terms, those are kind of helpful. The ego is sort of the adult person who sorts out things. The id is the more childlike, visceral, instinctive. The superego is a little more parental, the one, the conscience, the rules and regulations. Freud also postulated a fourth component that he didn't develop very well, and he called it the ego ideal. At some points, it seemed as if he intended that to be part of the superego, and at some points part of the ego, and at some points sort of in between. But where he did talk about shame, he suggested that shame is generated by a conflict between my ego ideal, in other words, my ideal self, how I want you to see me. You know, I want, my ego ideal is that you will see me today as competent, well-prepared, reasonably educated, somewhat articulate. And if somewhere along the line today I make a bad stumble, or, you know, discover that my fly is open or whatever, my ego will, of course, sort that out, pick that up, and I will have to deal with the conflict that that generates, that I know that I am not all that I really wanted to be. Okay? And so there's a tension and there's a conflict. Well, others have built on that too and worked with that a bit, but that's maybe one way to look at the how shame comes about. The other school of thought, which I'm going to spend more time on really, is a relational way of looking at shame, whereas Freud thought that most all of our neuroses were issues of tension within our own person, our memories from childhood over against adult experiences and that sort of thing. A later developing school of thought called objects relation theory, which tries to explain human development and growth in terms of how we relate to other people. Object relations is kind of an unfortunate choice. They don't mean by that how you relate to inanimate objects, but really to other people, things that are objectified and outside of yourself. That school of thought looks at shame, and I think takes us a little more deeply than the Freudian conflict model is really able to do, and suggests that shame is generated not just within me and my own ideas about what I want to be over against what I think or see myself as really being, but over against other people as I relate to them. For instance, if I risk myself in relationship with someone, and for any variety of reasons that relationship does not work, they don't just simply don't care for me, I may make some egregious faux pas that drives people away, who knows what happens, but I extend myself and my willingness to give of myself in relationship is not reciprocated, then that generates shame. Now, you can see there are some connections between these two, the conflict and the relational. It's something like trying to part the waters. You know, as soon as you get them parted, they run back together, and you can only briefly get things clarified, and then it gets murky again. But we'll try to think a little bit along those two kinds of lines of thought here. It's also, I think, important to say right at the outset that shame is painfully difficult to talk about. Now, I would take it from the number of you who came to the session that you all have some interest in exploring this or thinking about it or sharing some thoughts on it. But I think if any of us were really pressed to talk about our shame, we would be rather hard-pressed to find adequate words, to find a real comfort level with doing that in a large group of strangers. I don't expect anyone is really going to open up or want to share their deepest shame here. In fact, I'll probably try to inhibit that if someone wants to. It would probably be inappropriate. There is a, as someone has said, a kind of we feel a sense of shame about being ashamed. And that's one of the most difficult things about this issue, that to even begin to approach it often tends to generate or heighten the sense of shame. And therefore, it really takes a determined effort and a solid relationship situation in order to investigate and to feel your way through whatever the issues are that may relate to shame. I'm around for 2 weeks, and if you want to get into some of that on a personal level, I'm certainly willing and available to do that. In a really fine article that came out about the first part of the year in the Atlantic Monthly, simply called Shame, by Robert Caron, who's a journalist, but a well-read and well-written one, he makes the observation in this article that shame is by nature melodramatic. And I think that's right. You know, there isn't really, if we're really talking about shame, then we're not talking about anything that's casual. It's very deep, very hurtful, very significant. And therefore, to talk about it, if you really honestly share it, it is melodramatic. And we know how we relate to people who share melodramatic things. It's like, oh, brother, you know, deal with that. So it's very hard. And therefore, I think if we're really going to listen and try to be helpful to others and ourselves in dealing with shame issues, you have to kind of listen between the cracks. When you find yourself saying to someone, it was an awkward moment, you know, well, that's a kind of code word for shame almost. Or maybe we say something like, well, I was really uncomfortable, you know. It's hard to say and to explain what it means to say, I was just ashamed, you know. I really felt shame at that point. So we listen for the little code words along the way, I guess, in hopes of finding our way a little more clearly.
Brad?
Yeah?
When someone says, I was ashamed of her, is that projecting shame on another person?
It's interesting how we say that. We sometimes say, as you said, I was ashamed of her, and I was ashamed for her, you know, which can mean something kind of different.
In reverse of the shame on you, you always think of the parents saying to the
child, yeah.
You should feel ashamed.
See, I think there is a certain amount of projection when you say that, especially when parents say that. I was ashamed of my child. Well, part of the reason is that my ego ideal is invested in my little 10-month-old son, Martin, you know. if he was at this session screaming and making a fuss, I'd be ashamed of him. Well, he can't control that. But it does have something to do with my sense of who I am. I don't have a definitive answer for that, partly because, as I say, it's kind of an amorphous thing. As soon as you part the waters, it tends to run back together. It's interesting, even though, to note in biblical usage, we'll get into this a little more tomorrow, some different chains of meaning about shame and being ashamed. There are nuances. I guess that's, I don't know, is that helpful?
Yeah, what got me thinking about was in the conflict model, what if a person's operating out of a low self-esteem and has no big projection of themselves as a wonderful person, or perhaps doesn't have any expectations of their child or another person, then where would the shame arise? Or would there be any shame?
Well, see, I think Freud would say you've all got an ego ideal of some size, and unique and peculiar to you are the things that will trigger your sense of shame, depending on whatever that ego ideal may be. You know, ego ideal does not mean, as we popularly sometimes say, you know, boy, does Bill have an ego? You know, no. It simply means I have some idea of who I am. See, therefore, it can even, if my ego ideal is very, we would say, you know, small or insignificant, I don't expect much out of myself. And I actually experience a moment of, you know, public accomplishment. For some, that will be a moment of shame. I'll be kind of standing out there in the spotlight and won't know how to deal with it. So it's curious the things that will trigger shame. I think it's highly individual and unique. Again, it makes it hard to talk about. Somebody else had a comment over here. No?
Just that I deal with a lot of people with very low self-esteem as a public defender, and I think they live with shame all the time. And I think it's a matter of society's value of it. Being poor, being unmarried, being, you know, the bottom of the barrel and being looked down on.
Yeah. In terms of these five things I put up here, just some highlights, I think we'll get most to that point here under this category of the pain of shame. I want to say a few things about shame and guilt. Hope that may help here with your question too, Bill, about differentiating the two. Exposure and shame, the relational nature of shame, really hitting on this point. Some clues to shame, how to pick up on this maybe a little more. And then the pain of shame, because I think it is painful. Shame and guilt, they are often confused. They often run together. We often say one when we really mean the other because we haven't been taught really to think about them very clearly. Let me share a little vignette with you. This was this appeared in an article I wrote called Shame and the Human Predicament. And it's a real experience I had with someone who came to see me as a pastor. Richard, a salesman in his early 60s, recently sat in my study and talked about his marital difficulties. The marriage was not yet over, but it was clearly headed in that direction, and Richard was in obvious pain. His wife of some 30 years had declined to relocate with him when his company transferred him to our part of the country. He had hoped the separation would be only temporary, but as each day passed, it was clear to him that it would likely become permanent. "Pastor," he said, "I just don't understand it. In all our years of marriage, I never once cheated on my wife. I never drank. I don't smoke. I just wish she would tell me what I did, and then I could fix things." Well, that moment gave me a lot of cause to think later about what he was really saying. Notice how he frames his experience. "My pain, Pastor, is that I don't know what I did wrong. If she'd just tell me, you know, I never drank, I never smoked, I never cheated, he was looking for some cause of his guilt. You know, what was he guilty of? And as near as he could tell, he was guilty of nothing. And I would say that may in fact be the case. He may be guilty of nothing. Guilt issues have to do with what did I do? They are in the Freudian framework a conflict between your ego and your superego. Your superego, parent, conscience, and your ego trying to sort out the issues as something of an adult. Guilt is generated by, we might think of guilt as a transgression of boundaries. When I go out of bounds, I go beyond what is established as legal, legitimate, accepted. I transgress. That generates guilt. And one of the ways to then remedy guilt is through forgiveness and restitution. Now, we're into a bit of theology, which we'll get more into tomorrow, but they tend to cross over. If I've done something wrong, then I need to be forgiven for what I've done wrong and do whatever I reasonably can to make it right. That's how I address my guilt. Shame is different. Shame is not so much an issue of what I have done, but more an issue of who I am. And so with this man Richard, he's looking for the what did I do, when in fact it may be an issue of who he is as a person, that after 30 years his wife has just said, I just can't any longer live with this. You know, it's no one thing he's done or hasn't done. It's who he is that's making it difficult for me to relate. This is a little simplistic, but sometimes it helps. If you think of human life as being worked out on a football field, okay, you might think of guilt issues happen by going out of bounds. Shame is generated when you fall short of the goal, okay? You want to get to whatever represents the end zone for you. And when we find ourselves striving and we fall short of that, and we recognize that we fall short of that, that tends to generate shame. The going out of bounds, you know, trying to run where you should not really run, you know, that's illegal in football, you can't do that, is a guilt kind of thing. I know that's a little simplistic, but somehow it helps, I think. I think it was Helen Merrill Lynn in that early book who pointed out something else very significant about the difference. What the implied punishment or fear is behind shame and guilt. The implied fear with guilt is, I misspoke myself, the implied fear with guilt is punishment. If I do something wrong, I will be punished. But the implied fear about shame is abandonment. I am afraid that if I risk myself and they don't like me, nobody's going to come back for my session tomorrow. You know, I will be abandoned. That's very simplistic. I mean, it goes a lot deeper than that, for instance, with children. Shame can be generated very early on. That's where the object relations people are helpful. As children have the experience that they are not wanted or loved, and therefore they are abandoned. So there's some connection between shame and abandonment and guilt and punishment that is very important. I mentioned a moment ago too that if the way to resolve guilt is by forgiveness or some sort of restitution, you can begin to see how that doesn't work with shame. Because when you're feeling shame, the issue is not what have I done, as with Richard, the salesman. The issue is who am I as a person? And you can't forgive me for who I am. I mean, it's who I am. It's only something, I think, grace, which, I mean, seems too simple, but it's the best I can come up with. Grace or acceptance is more the theological response that helps heal the shame. And I think that's where John Bradshaw and his stuff about healing the shame that binds you would say much the same thing, you know, a sense of self-acceptance and significant relationships where a person is accepted helps to heal that. I know we need to push on, but on this shame and guilt issue, is that any questions? Does that help clarify some? Again, I know you push them apart and they run back together, but please.
As I've listened to you and been thinking about this, thinking about the lady over here that commented about her experience as public defender, I wonder if it is possible that shame is a response to power and control.
Quite. I'll say more about that in a minute, but yeah.
And even your counselee, I could hear in that story an issue for him of power and control. His wife had power and control over him, and his response to that was shame. You know, it must be me. What did I do? Never thought that it could be her.
Right. And paradoxically, one of the ways that we defend against our sense of shame then is to feel a deep need to be in control and to be very enraged when we can't be in control. We'll get to that under the clues for shame here in a minute. But yeah, there are definitely issues there that tie in, without question. Let me share another little vignette with you here as we move on to this theme of exposure and shame. This is out of Robert Caron's article, a little autobiographical moment. He writes, "I recently picked up 3 books on the sale table of a bookstore near where I live. The sign said 25% off all marked prices. But the cashier gave me 25% off only the one book."
Excuse me a minute. Is Dr. Coles in the room?
Yes.
We need you.
Sorry to lose you. The sign said 25% off all marked prices, but the cashier gave me 25% off only on the one book that had a red slash through the price. As I was leaving, I saw the sign again and realized the cashier had been wrong. She pointed me to the manager, who took the books from my hand. As we looked at the prices, I was embarrassed to realize that a ridiculously small sum was involved. What? You want your dollar back? He said. I heard his tone, but didn't know how to respond. When I started to say something, he interrupted, telling me that he'd rather give me my dollar than take up more time. Give him his dollar, he called to the cashier across the crowded store. I got my dollar and walked out, feeling like 2 cents. I think everyone understands this moment. It has become part of our urban experience, an example of the casual emotional abuse with which people manipulate, control, and punish the strangers they deal with. But not everyone recognizes the shame that lies beneath the rage that such experiences engender. Whenever we are put down, shame of some kind is stirred up. The store manager does not need to know what my soft spots are. His derisive, demissive attitude will find my feelings of shame like a heat-seeking missile. Part of what's going on in that little vignette is exposure. He's out there. You want your dollar? I mean, even over a dollar. The Latin root for exposure, the Latin word is exponere, which means to put out or to place out. In other words, you're out there, you're on the table. It's an experience of being seen when you don't want to be seen. You know, all those horrible dreams of, you know, being up in front of a group of people and you discover you don't have any clothes on or something. In fact, you know, what do you often hear, what have you maybe said yourself? In a moment of shame, people often say, oh, I just wanted to disappear. You know, I wished I, this is the posture, right? You want to just get out of sight. Why? Because you've been exposed. You've been seen in a way that you did not want to be seen. And the natural reaction is, I want to be invisible. I would have just liked to slink through a hole and died, you know. Again, I think that adds some credence to the relational point of view, that I experience this shame in the eyes of other people. Part of what some cultures have when they talk about the evil eye, you know, that a person has. It's that person's capacity to shame you into submission. Go ahead, comment? Yeah.
Could I just relate one example?
Sure.
There's a book by a man named Needleman about money.
Hmm.
And he's a teacher of philosophy somewhere in San Francisco, in the university. And he said he went, during the era of the hippies in San Francisco, he went into a store and he said, boy, this is my kind of stuff. And they had all pictures of his various gurus on the wall, you know, and people who loved beads and things like that. And he was so happy, found something he wanted and went to buy it. And then they demanded cash from him. They wouldn't accept his check. And he got in a heated argument with these people. And then he said, you know, here I'm supposed to be a teacher of philosophy, you know, and he felt so foolish with it for himself.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a good example of shame.
Yeah, it's a good example of one of Helen Merrill Lynn's categories, characteristics of shame, that she called incongruity. It's this catching yourself as, wait, this is not the persona that I want to project.
Yeah, that's.
But I was somehow incapable of not being that. Ooh, that's, again, I'm out there. I don't want to be out there. A little footnote here, maybe too, psychologically speaking. It has struck me in reading a lot of literature about shame and the therapeutic approaches to shame and the helpfulness of being in a therapeutic relationship. I think there needs to be a great deal of caution exercised, especially when we deal with the so-called insight therapies, a kind of Freudian approach that asks people to draw from themselves new insights to help see themselves in a different and new way. I think psychologists need to be a little more aware that when dealing with shame, once a person begins to discover insights about their own shaming experiences, perhaps even as far back as childhood, that immediately engenders more shame. To share that, even in a fairly trusting therapeutic relationship, it's a very tricky, difficult kind of a thing. It's almost like you're shining a big floodlight on a person, you know. There you are. I mean, insight, by just the definition of the word, means to, you know, to see into. I have seen and read some rather facile things about shame and how to treat shame and so forth. And I would say we need to be cautious. Even if we talk to people, you know, just conversationally and as friends, and they're willing to share with us some moment of shame, we need to be very respectful of that. That's a very precious thing if they're even willing to share that with us. And the sharing of it is probably creates some shame. That there needs to be in place a pretty good, healthy relationship in order for those kind of issues to be worked out and worked on. One person, Gershon Kaufman, who's written a book on shame, calls that the interpersonal bridge. And what often happens, he says, one of the reasons for shame is our interpersonal bridges break down and we lose the connections we have with other people. And the way to begin to heal shame is to rebuild carefully those interpersonal bridges so that we can really have commerce with one another back and forth. It's a helpful image. Yeah.
Breaks down with one person, sometimes you just cut off all contact with that person.
Yep. But say a little more about that.
Well, I have a good friend who always manages to find some problem I've had or some weakness, and we end up every time I meet with her talking about that, and I go away feeling exhausted
yeah.
and troubled and not necessarily help, so I delay the times I see her anymore because it always seems to, she always picks at those little problems I have, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and your other interpersonal bridges probably lose a few planks in the process. I mean, they become a little more tentative.
Sometimes, although I turn to them and be dealing with them usually. So
yeah.
That's yeah. how I handle it.
Yeah, please.
One of the things I found in my work at college is sometimes, not very often, but sometimes I get myself in deep water. And that's because sometimes one of my students will confide something. And I found it's very effective sometimes to divulge something about myself. Well, sometimes, even though it's very, you know, one of my students had lost a baby due to sudden infant death syndrome. And I told her, I said, I'm not a psychologist, so I think you need to talk this way. Well, you know, she wants to talk about it. So I said, well, you know, I lost a brother. Well, even the very simple kinds of things, it was just too powerful for her to handle, just some of the things I shared with her. And she later came back and told me, after she kind of get together, that you just could handle that. So even I think, you know, when you have a very simple situation, sometimes you have to watch what you
know. It can be hard.
It's a status issue, in a way. To share shame is going one down, and so it could. It's a risk that. If someone does it with you, you should recognize.
Yeah, that there is a risk that's been taken.
Yeah.
We're already headed there. I'm going to move along into this issue of relational nature of shame, right along with what you're both saying. Here's another little vignette. This is from a book written by a man named Carl Schneider called Shame, Exposure, and Privacy. Again, a fairly early book, mid to late 70s, I think, when he wrote this, and one of the better theological treatments of shame. Listen in this story about a 12-year-old boy, a little description here, the relational issues that are at stake. A 12-year-old boy has begun to value his relationship with a considerably older brother, even desiring to emulate him. The two make plans to purchase season football tickets, an activity highly prized by the older for the coming year. This is in the fall, and all through that next year, the young boy expectantly looks ahead to the exciting adventure with his older brother. Little need be said of the forthcoming event, yet the boy has come to count on it. That spring, The older brother becomes engaged and marries later that summer. In the fall, with the football season approaching, nothing more is said of their prior plan to go to the games. In fact, the brother and his new wife purchased the coveted football tickets for themselves, with not a word being said to the younger boy. The boy's expectations are smashed, suddenly exposed as wrong. The very thing he has come silently to depend upon is exposed as inconsequential to the deeply valued older brother. There's a lot going on there, to be sure. But notice how he describes at the end, the conclusion that the younger brother draws is, I was somehow wrong. Not I did something wrong, but I was wrong. Because I trusted in my older brother. I just assumed that you could count on things like this. And it didn't go the way that I expected, and no, I small. Yeah. Did somebody have a comment over here? Please.
I was asking what the name of that
book was. Oh, it's called Shame, Exposure, and Privacy. Carl Schneider.
I guess that's a new way for me to think about shame. I would define that as disappointment, disillusionment, or
yeah.
loss of an ideal mm-hmm. or something like that. But shame, given that come into my vocabulary.
Yeah. But think about in this instance, I mean, this was obviously very formative at 12 years old, you know, it's a really crucial age. What's at stake for this boy is his sense of self. You know, who am I in relationship to my brother? Am I valued? Remember what we said a bit ago. The implied fear with shame is abandonment. He's not going to acknowledge me anymore. Now, it may not, that same situation may not generate any shame for some other person. That's not prescriptive, it's just descriptive. But I think we can see in this case how that could easily come to play. It always makes me think of a situation when I was about 12, I think, 11 or 12. My sister had a boyfriend. She was a senior. No, she it was her freshman year in college. She met this guy who was big into horseback riding. I didn't know anything about horseback riding, but I always thought it sounded great. He promised me one time that he was going to come up from Columbus to where I lived, and we were going to go horseback riding. I had some friends who had horses, so I called them, and we set that up and whatnot. And he didn't show up. Called me about a half hour late to say, something came up, you know, and I can't make it. Well, I was deeply disappointed. But see, at 12 years old, you don't really have permission to get angry with somebody who's clearly your senior and has authority. You don't really know how to deal with that. So it rang the bell for me that one of my experiences with that was I questioned, well, you know, was there something wrong with my request to, you know, to ask for this from him? I was embarrassed and ashamed for my friends who I'd set up the horseback riding thing with. I had to call them and say, well, you know, Steve's not coming, we can't come. And it was just awkward. Well, see, I'm saying it. It was awkward. Code word. I felt small, you know, ashamed. I could probably deal with that differently now, but then it wasn't so easy to do. See, yeah, go ahead.
See, listen. It always takes us back to when we were little children. And we're so dependent on other people. When I feel the most shame is when I am greeted with someone who is demanding and arbitrary, and like a teacher, or you know, who yells at me. If I get screamed at by someone, I feel about 2 years old again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very significant to me right now with our son who's 10 months old, because I've been reading some of this material and refreshing my memory. In the first year of life, from 6 months to maybe 18 months, it begins to be very important that when children, even that small, look at you, and Martin's just at this age now where if you see him, he'll look at you, he wants your reaction. He wants to charm you. He wants to know that he can make you smile back. Now, I know that won't last forever, but for now, it's very important for his sense of identity as far as who he is, that he can engage with someone and get them to react. So it's very important, becoming more and more important for me, that when he looks at me, I make sure I engage him and smile back. And you know you don't do that perfectly. Sometimes you're just in a hurry and you look away. And it's amazing what happens with children. They will look at you, and if you don't look back and they don't get a reaction, they'll go like this. They just kind of go like this, and then they start to play with whatever, you know. They look down, and they don't understand what's happening, of course, but they feel small. They thought they were giving something of themselves, and it wasn't reciprocated. Well, I would suggest to you that gets played out over and over again through the rest of our adult life. We give ourselves to people, and they don't respond, and we're left having to deal with whatever that may mean. Now, there are excessive and unhealthy ways to deal with that, too. All this huge, vast literature now of codependency, and which is a term that's come to mean everything and therefore almost nothing, but there is something to that. Healthy adults learn that every time you give of yourself, you will not always receive back in kind, and that does not mean I'm a terrible person or something's wrong with me. Nonetheless, those parts of ourselves can be pricked and can engender the shame. Please.
It seemed to me one of the most common example of shame is children in toilet training.
Oh yeah.
You know,
dirty.
I remember not doing too well in the second grade. Okay, and I mean, I still feel funny about that.
Yep.
But I also, on top of that, I feel anger at the teacher now, thinking about that she did not create an atmosphere
yes.
where you felt comfortable in saying something.
Right, and because when we are shamed by someone like that, we are so powerless that the only reaction reasonably that you can have is, I'd say beyond anger, it's rage, you know. You want to get this person. Because what else can you do? I mean, your dignity is gone if you've messed your pants, you know, in school. What can you do? And the unfortunate part is that rage, because it's obviously inappropriate to ream out your second grade teacher, you know. There's only one place for that to go, you know, and it's right back here with me. You know, an 8-year-old, or so, you don't have the psychological equipment to know how to process that. You just feel it in a surge, and then it just rests here, and you carry that around for a long time. Only to later in life, something else is going to shame us, and boy, the rage is right to the front. Angry and defensive and feisty. I'm going to say a little more tomorrow when we talk about a theology or a theological approach to shame about what I think is a biblical perspective on shame, which has to do with misplaced trust. Shame has an awful lot to do with who do I trust. The Bible points out often in the Psalms, the psalmist says, O Lord, in you have I put my faith, let me not be put to shame. Who should be put to shame? Let my enemies who have not trusted in you be put to shame. In other words, God, I have trusted that you will be with me. Now don't leave me hanging out here, you know, to be derided and made fun of. I think we can say theologically that shame does happen when we put our ultimate trust in things that are not ultimately trustworthy. What is often the case in relationships that break down is we've overinvested ourselves in some person. I thought she was going to, you know, be the be-all and end-all. And of course, nobody can be all that. And it breaks down and we wonder and then we get shamed. Theologically, I think part of the sorting out is the issue of what is an appropriate place for my trust to come to rest? We'll get into that more, but I think it taps into this relational nature of shame and has to do with our relationship with God as well. That's it. Can you stand one more vignette here? On the control issue here. On to the bit about the clues to shame. Here's another Goodness gracious. Robert Caron writes long articles. Here we go. A little clip from Robert Caron again. He says, and he's quoting Michael Bash, who's a psychiatrist, unless they control everything, this guy says, of people with narcissistic tendencies, the old sense of shame gets reactivated. We see it in the winter. Now picture this. We read stories in the newspaper where, when the car won't start, someone takes out a pistol and shoots his car. That's to compensate for the shame. I don't work. I can't make it happen. Or if the kid flunks a course in school, the parent gets enraged because the child is an extension of himself or herself, and when the child doesn't get an A, that means to the parent, I'm worthless and everybody will know it. I remember a little bit Garrison Keillor did a while back. You all know Garrison Keillor, Prairie Home Companion, etc. Lyle, the seventh grade science teacher, is coming out of the sidetrack tap on a cloudy March day, and it's just one of those gloomy days that you don't feel much good for anything. And he comes out, gets in his car, and it can't get it started. Vroom, 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 and it dies out, and he gets out, and he walks around the car, and he kicks the tires, and he can't believe this is happening to him. And then the phone in the phone booth right by his parked car rings. And he's like, oh. And he picks it up, and the voice, this whole monologue of Keillor's was about the voice, but the voice says to him, quit giving it so much gas, stupid, you'll flood it. And he hangs up. Well, you know, it's that feeling of being out of control and then somebody has to remind you of what you're doing. Keillor has a very perceptive sense about what it means to be shamed as one of the world's original shy people, you know, as he talks as himself. Well, one of the clues to shame, you want to know when shame is an issue, is pick up on people's rage and anger that they use to defend themselves against shame. People who have, or maybe I should say, when we have trouble with being vulnerable with other people and sharing ourselves, it's often because somewhere along the line we have been deeply shamed, and then we defend against that with a sense of hurt and rage. Example, just recently, I'm working with a couple who's contemplating getting married. They're trying to sort out a very complicated, difficult relationship. He has a real chip on his shoulder about women, we're coming to discover. He will often say to her, women are no good, I've never had a good relationship with women, and of course this is very hurtful to her, she's trying very hard, and she says to me, you know, I don't understand why he says this, what's the deal? Well, we probe that a little bit. Well, we come to discover that he's got some real codependent features to his personality. He wants to please everybody, and he has from time to time tried enormously in his business life to accommodate what some women, some rather pushy women, I would say, have wanted from him. You know, can you make this delivery? Why can't you get this shipment out in time, and so forth? He does his best, and of course it doesn't work because nobody can live up to those kind of global, vague, expectations. And then it falls flat, and he gets enraged. And then he displaces that rage on his now fiancée. Well, we're trying to sort that out. But as I heard his rage about that, I began to work back and think with him to see that, yeah, at certain points, and I'll bet if we push all the way back into his childhood, we'll find he experienced some considerable shame. He's also of an ethnic background, not native to our area, so, you know, there may be something to that that plugs in too, I don't know. But with an eye out for the rage and so forth, we might spot clues to shame. Well, let's see. Do I have one more minute? I'll give you one last vignette for you to take home with you on this issue of the pain of shame. And I really didn't have anything particularly to say about this. In fact, I just wrote at the bottom of my notes, what can you say? I mean, what can you say about this? I don't know. But again, it's from Robert Caron's article. Listen to how he describes a sequence of events here about a young woman and the shame she feels about this. A young woman is having some friends and acquaintances over for a rare brunch. Only 6 of the 10 invited were able to come. The poor showing is a humiliation for the hostess, who is ashamed in front of the remaining guests. She fears they see how unpopular and disregarded she is. The hostess does not know 3 of her guests very well. They are acquaintances from her department at work. And they do not seem to be mixing much with the others. They are more successful people, really going somewhere in life as the hostess sees it, and now she feels a fool for having invited them, having reached out for people who have no interest in her. In fact, she is quite certain that despite their cordiality, they came only to be polite. For a moment, the encroaching shame panics her. She finds herself talking excessively. She wants to explain, to be liked despite it all, to make a group coalesce into a successful party. She makes excuses for the food, for her decor. It's only temporary, she says. She feels bad for having betrayed herself like that, laughs nervously, hears herself laugh, suspects that her merriment sounds forced and unnatural. Her guests seem uncomfortable. She wishes the whole thing would end. Later, when everyone's gone, she's sure they're thinking, oh God, that was really stupid. Well, I leave you with that. Yeah. Tomorrow we'll talk about a theology of shame, and I hope begin to unpack some of that. Oh, well, you can grab the tape later. Thanks for being here.
You know, another example, and I don't know, this is true of everybody, is a shame when you've paid too much for something.
Yes. Okay?
Say a house, and then you try to sell it, and people end up doing funny things to say they got their right price, you know, or anything, a car. They do a lot of rationalization to get away from that shame.
And the self-justifying, rationalizing behavior is another way to defend against the shame. Yeah, I mean, we both know people who, you'd swear they never paid full price for anything. I mean, every single thing is, I only bought this because I got a fabulous deal, it was on sale. I mean,
everybody won in Las Vegas.
Yeah. And I find myself often justifying that, you know.
Yeah, that's a really common one.
And it's a way to avoid the shame of sort of being out there, you know, and having people see, yeah, this is what I really invested in this. Mm-hmm. And the possibility that I goofed it, you know, that I wasn't as shrewd as. But again, it's relational. You know, I'm measuring myself over against other people.
Yeah.
At some point, you're just playing with words. But I think that I would say shame is just the deeper concept. Embarrassment passes a little more quickly, and I get over it a little more quickly. Shame is somehow more visceral, deeper, I think. Some psychological writings, you know, go through a real incredible grid of listing those words and descriptions and trying to parse them out. I'll leave you to those folks, but that's, I guess, how I deal with it. I think it's gradations.
So a lot of what you said, I would think of embarrassment rather than shame.
I would say not different from, but maybe deeper, or not quite as deep as, would be the way that I would sort that. I don't think so, because I think guilt can really be generated by other people.
Okay.
You know that too. You know, somebody can make you feel guilty. But see, part of what they're doing when they make you feel guilty is they're really making you feel ashamed. And this business of, you know, give guilt the gift that keeps on giving. Some of that is shame.
Okay.
Yes, but I think because guilt has to do with the breaking of boundaries, those are often, you know, parentally, for instance, established by other people who do have legitimate authority to set them for us. We'll talk about that some more tomorrow with the, I'm going to talk about the theological uses of the law, the civil use and the theological use. See, I think the civil use, what Luther called the civil use of the law, is a guilt issue. And the theological use of the law that's supposed to drive us to the gospel and make us see ourselves for who we really are in the presence of God, that's a shame issue, I think. So that's how I'm trying to work with shame theologically, is correlate it with law. And I think Lutherans have done the guilt thing, you know, up one side, down the other. But I would make the case that in Luther's theology and thinking, intuitively, although he used the word guilt because he had read Helen Merrill Lynn and Freud and all those other, often what he was really talking about was shame. I mean, the concept, if you look at what he's dealing with, was this sense of inadequacy, you know, impossible, his own experience of being just, you know, impossible to relate to God because of who he was. He tried to do everything he knew how to do, and in the end he ended up saying, there's nothing I can do, you know. Well, he found the answer to his shame, I think, when he could say, nevertheless, I'm baptized. I know what my identity is because God conferred it upon me, and I didn't have to do anything to earn that.